Okay, the words of another world leader are captivating huge audiences. Against all Vatican expectations, the Twitter account of Pope Francis, in Latin, has gained more than 100,000 followers. And it's not just Catholics or Latin scholars. The followers come from religions and professions all over the world. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli tells us why the language of the ancient Romans is perfectly suited to 21st century social media.
Pope Benedict launched the first papal Twitter account in December in 8 languages, including Arabic, and soon there were millions of followers. Then letters started pouring in asking why isn't the Pope tweeting in the official language of the Vatican. When the Latin account was launched in January, Vatican officials didn't expect more than 5,000 Latin nerds, that is, followers. But by May, it had surpassed Polish and was in a tie with German at over 100,000.
The surprise has been nerds are in all walks of life. Cab drivers from South Africa, homemakers, for lack of a better term, journalists.
Monsignor Daniel Gallagher is one of the 6 language experts working in the Vatican's Latin office. He says followers are of all ages.
Kids who are 8 years old up to people who are 88 are also following the conversation and participating in the conversation.
Father Gallagher says his office gets letters as well as tweets from all over the world, including from many Muslims and atheists who don't necessarily like the Catholic Church, but are grateful it's keeping the ancient language alive. The Vatican's Latin expert acknowledges that Twitter can encourage shallow thinking and knee-jerk reactions, but he's convinced Latin's flexibility, where one word translated into English or Spanish would require many more, makes it better suited for tweeting than many other languages.
Because it tends to express thoughts as briefly, as concisely, as precisely as possible.
If Twitter had existed during Roman antiquity, the person with the most followers would probably have been the satirist Martial, creator of the epigram. Here's one in 78 characters, including spaces.
Omnia promitis cum tota nocte bibisti. Mane nihil prestas, polio mane bibe.
You were making all kinds of promises when you drink at night. You're just a little tipsy and you say whatever you want. But in the morning, you don't follow through. So, Pollio, why don't you drink in the morning?
Or this famous poem by Catullus.
Odiet amo quare id faciam fortasse requiris, nescio sed fieri sentio et excrucior.
I hate and I love at the same time. Why do I do this, for perhaps you ask? I have no idea, but I feel it happening and I'm being tortured by it.
In just 2 lines, 82 characters, the meaning of life, a perfect tweet. When the Vatican was preparing to launch the Latin Twitter account, it ruled out the Latin word for the sound of chirping birds, pipilare, saying it didn't sound serious enough for the Pope. So they took a cue from the orator Cicero, who once wrote to a friend while he was in a hurry. Brevi loquentem iam me tempus ipsum facit. Time itself is forcing me to speak briefly. The name of the Twitter account is Summi Pontificis Breviloquentis, the briefly speaking Supreme Pontiff. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
As the Romans would say, hic locus est NPR. And now a murder mystery of sorts. The scene of the crime, Everglades National Park. We already know the murderer, the giant Burmese python. The species has invaded Florida. The mystery lies in identifying its victims. As NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, a forensics expert is on the case.
Carla Dove opens a small white box. She's sitting at a lab bench in her office at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History.
It's kind of like Christmas for me because I never know what's going to be in these packages.
Inside are a bunch of sandwich-sized Ziploc bags.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 samples today.
Each sample consists of grayish pieces of feathers and sometimes bones, all from inside the stomachs and intestines of Burmese pythons. These giant snakes are thriving in the Everglades and devouring local birds and animals.
Let's look at this one first. This is python number 780. It was collected on the 18th of March, 2013, so it's a recent one.
Park officials are interested in the diets of these pythons because they want to know what native species might be threatened. Now, when it comes to animals, they pretty much know that the snakes eat rabbits, foxes, even alligators. They've often caught them in the act. But it's been harder to know what birds they've been snacking on. That's where Carla Dove comes in.
We can see what's in here and go to work on identifying the birds that this nasty snake has been eating.
Now, you can't identify the birds from their DNA because these half-digested remains are contaminated with snake DNA. So it's a question of recognizing the birds just from their feathers.
Sometimes they are nice and complete feathers and I can recognize them right away.
But often she only has tiny fragments to go on. She uses tweezers to pull a piece out from one of the Ziploc bags.
Even though it's as tiny as a strand of hair, really, it could be enough to have some special diagnostic microscopic features that might help us determine if it's a heron or maybe it's a bird of prey or a pigeon or a dove.
This piece is a downy bit from the base of a feather, what scientists call barbules. Dove places it gently on a glass slide and turns on her microscope.
I'll let you have a look at this. In the middle of this slide, there's a tiny piece of a downy barbule that has me excited.
To me, it's just a bunch of fine, transparent needles with bits of color here and there. But Dove recognizes the pattern instantly. It belongs to a group of birds that includes cranes and rails, but
it's different from the rest of the birds that it's related to.
She still has to confirm it, but she suspects the python's victim was a limpkin. Now, most days, Dove spends her time investigating the remains of birds who've died in very different circumstances. Birds who've crashed into airplanes. Like the flock of starlings that brought down a flight off of Boston Harbor back in 1960. The crash destroyed the plane and killed most of its passengers.
After the Boston crash, the airline industry started to get really interested in birds that are causing damage to airplanes.
Most bird strikes don't cause crashes, but it's still really important to know what species was involved, so you can change flight paths or alter the airport environment or design stronger aircraft engines.
Knowing the exact species of bird that is on your airfield and causing a problem is the very first step in trying to reduce this risk.
And there's a huge demand for Dove's expertise. Just this past year, she processed about 8,000 cases, many of them involving military airplanes.
We get a lot of samples from Afghanistan. That's because we're doing a lot of flying there.
A few years ago, she solved the mystery of a large unknown bird that flew into a fighter jet at Bagram Air Base. Michael Beter is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Airport Wildlife Hazards Program. He was called in by the Air Force to help with the case.
There were several millions of dollars worth of damage.
Dove had identified the offending bird as a black kite.
The black kite is a raptor, but it's similar in size to some of the vulture species we have in North America.
And it was up to Beter and his team to prevent such accidents from happening again. So they went out to Bagram Air Base and started looking for black kites.
One of the things that we discovered was that trash disposal at the base, it was in a spot that brought the birds closer to the runway and to the flight path of the jets.
Once the trash was removed, the birds disappeared. One of the reasons Dove is able to identify birds from anywhere in the world is because the Smithsonian Museum has a massive collection of birds. Dove takes me out into a climate-controlled hallway, stacked from floor to ceiling with cabinets.
So this collection is like my library. This is my reference.
The library has 620,000 specimens from all over the world. And in fact, Dove's work with the military in Afghanistan has added 80 new species to the museum's collection. But it's the python victims that are on our mind today. She wants to confirm that the fragment she saw under the microscope was indeed from a limpkin.
So we go to the limpkin drawer, slide off the case door.
She's in luck, because in addition to that fragment, the Ziploc bag also contained a single intact feather. She holds it against the wing feathers of a very still, very dead bird that looks a bit like a browner, smaller version of a heron. The match is perfect.
So, I think we have solved this case. Python number 780 was feasting on a limpkin on the 18th of March, 2013.
Dove's keen eye and knowledge of feathers has come from more than two decades of practice, and she's the only person in the country with these skills. But she worries about the future of this kind of analysis.
Unless I have someone to follow me around and do some research on the microscopic structure of feathers, I think that one of these days the whole expertise in this field is going to go away.
She inherited this lab from the only other person in the country who did this kind of work. But she says she's yet to find the person who will take over this unique feather forensics lab. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News, Washington.
The aptly named Carla Dove has determined that pythons like to snack on some 30 species of birds, including limpkins, mallards, egrets, herons, and wood storks. To date, Dove has examined the remains of nearly 150 Burmese pythons. You can learn more about her work and also take a virtual tour of her lab by watching a slideshow at npr.org.
And let's go now to our series, Dollar for Dollar, where NPR's Uri Berliner has been trying to figure out what to do with money in a savings account that's been losing value to inflation. He's putting $5,000 from that account to the test. So far, he has invested in assets like stocks, purchased entirely on the basis of their future potential earnings. Today, Uri wades into the art world, where the rewards are not always financial.
If you go onto a site like ArtNet or Saatchi Online, you can shop for art by price, style, or even size. It's not that different from buying a mutual fund on the web. This suits Cappy Price just fine. She's a former Wall Street portfolio manager who now consults with clients about art as an alternative asset. She loves art for its beauty, but she also says it's an investable asset, one that wasn't really accessible to ordinary people until recently.
The internet is driving the ability of the masses to do their own research, do their own due diligence, just as they do with a stock, really enabling individuals to determine and place their own value on individual pieces of art.
Why invest in art? One reason, says Cappy Price, fine art has a proven track record as a good choice during hard times.
It outperforms in times of economic turmoil and trouble. It has outperformed during all of the wars of the 20th century. It's outperformed during the last 27 recessions.
Like any other asset, the market for art goes through ups and downs. Over the past 60 years, the total return on art has been very similar to the return on the S&P 500, says Mike Moses. A retired NYU business school professor, he's the co-creator of the May Moses World All Art Index. The index tracks repeat auction sales of fine art.
If you use the last 30 years, the S&P substantially outperforms art. If you look at the most recent 8-10 years, art has outperformed the S&P.
For paintings in my price range, we're talking a few hundred dollars. There's no May Moses index, no record of auction sales to use as a guide. So I have no idea whether it's a smart move financially for me to buy art. But I do know this. Art is different than other investments. It's there in your house, part of your life.
You are telling people something about yourself when you hang it. I think that emotional investment gives you, a certain tie to that work that you don't find in other objects that you buy.
Now, the emotion part of the equation is fairly simple. As I look through hundreds of paintings online, I know for sure I won't buy a rendering of a clown or a panda eating an ice cream cone. The hard part is assessing value in what's so fundamentally a subjective purchase. So I ask Cappy Price, how can I tell if a painting selling for, say, $500 or $1,000 is worth it?
You look at the comparables, you see what their peers are selling their work for, work that is, similarly sized, and start from there.
Before too long, searching online, I find a painting I want. It's an abstract work called Flower Study 14, inspired by irises.
They're fresh. They're spring colors, yellow, blue, green, white.
That's the artist. His name is Vladimir Krylov, and I reach him in Vilnius, Lithuania, on his cell phone. A full-time painter, Krylov sells work from his studio and online. The way the web relentlessly categorizes art by price, style, and size, that doesn't bother him at all. He says it allows him to watch the competition and keeps him in shape. And he seems comfortable straddling two worlds, art as commerce and art as passion.
After all, most people buy art because we love it.
I purchased Flower Study 14 somewhat impulsively. I didn't bother with research. I just liked the way it looked. I pay $450 for the painting and $139 to have it shipped from Vilnius to Washington, D.C. Krylov appreciates my appreciation, but I say, what if I turn it around and flip it for a quick profit? What would you think?
It all depends on the price. The offer would be too good to refuse. Probably you would be right to accept it.
I check in with Cappy Price one last time after making my online purchase. Not a bad choice, she says, especially because it's painted in the style of the Impressionists. They're always popular, but...
It's unlikely you'd be able to turn around and sell it tomorrow. This is an emerging artist. This is an artist who is not a brand name. Well, that, again, goes toward perhaps there being some difficulty in reselling the work.
Who knows? Maybe, as Vladimir Krylov says, I'll wind up getting an offer that's too good to refuse and bank a profit. But if not, I'll be happy to keep Flower Study 14 hanging on my wall. Uri Berliner, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. U.S. health officials say a controversial vaccine against the HPV virus is working better than expected. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted infection. It's the cause of virtually all cervical cancer, and it's linked to other cancers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has said that all teenagers and young adults should get vaccinated, but so far, very few have. NPR's Richard Knox has our story.
When the first vaccine against the human papillomavirus, or HPV, was approved 7 years ago, the studies showed it should drastically lower a person's chance of getting infected. But Dr. Thomas Frieden says that doesn't necessarily mean the vaccines, there are two of them now, would be that good outside a study.
We knew that it was effective in clinical trials, but you always like to see what happens in the real world. So these results are extremely encouraging. They show that the vaccine works, and it works really well.
Frieden is director of the CDC, and he says he's very happy to be announcing such good news. The results appear in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. They show that nationwide infections of the strains of HPV the vaccines protect against plummeted by more than half in the 4 years after they began to be used. That's especially surprising because only one in three teenage girls has gotten the three recommended doses of the vaccine. Frieden says more infections could be prevented if more kids got the vaccine.
The coverage is very disappointing. It's certainly not good enough to protect women from cervical cancer.
The U.S. rate of HPV vaccination is much lower than in other countries, Australia, for example, or even Rwanda.
That lower rate has very concrete implications. It means that among girls alive today, age 0 to 13, 50,000 are going to develop cervical cancer that would have been prevented if we had reached the goal of 80% vaccination rate.
Health officials say both girls and boys should get the vaccine at age 11 or 12 because it protects better in the long run. Frieden says parents resist the idea of vaccinating their preteen girls in particular against a sexually transmitted virus.
By saying that girls should get vaccinated starting at age 11, we're not saying we think girls are going to have sex at age 11.
Another source of resistance is worry about the vaccine safety, says Dr. Lori Moskowitz of the CDC.
We know that there's a concern about safety because there's been a lot of information in the lay press about this, but we've been trying to increase the communications around safety to let people know the good safety profile that this vaccine has.
Norma Erickson doesn't believe it. She's with a group called SaneVax. Its website features pictures of young women who died after getting vaccinated against HPV.
We are convinced that people have died after taking the vaccine. It's our premise that it's not up to the parents to prove that it was or was not the vaccine. It's up to the manufacturers and the health authorities to prove that it wasn't.
At a telephone press conference today, Cindy Weinbaum of the CDC says the agency knows of deaths among people who got the vaccine, but has no reason to think they're related.
There is no consistent pattern among the deaths that have occurred to people after they've been vaccinated that would give us any cause to be concerned at all that these deaths might be at all related.
Unfortunately, young people die of other things, and sometimes that happens after getting vaccinated. But it doesn't mean the vaccine caused the death. Richard Knox, NPR News.
When well over 1,000 people died in a factory collapse in Bangladesh earlier this year, many consumers in the United States were outraged to learn about the dangerous working conditions in overseas garment factories. The shock was shared by consumers in Spain, home to some of the world's biggest low-cost fashion retailers. And from Madrid, Lauren Freyer sent us this story.
This is Madrid's posh Gran Vía, the Spanish equivalent of New York's Fifth Avenue, where the biggest names in fast fashion, Zara, Mango, H&M, have flagship stores. Throngs of shoppers and tourists pack these wide sidewalks and then suddenly stop dead in their tracks. Three glamorous models dressed up in the latest fashions are sprawled face down on the pavement, buried in rubble, their high heels askew. Tourists gasp. Some take photos. A crowd forms. And one woman hangs back, observing from afar.
My name is Yolanda Dominguez, and I am a visual artist.
The models are alive and well, part of Dominguez's latest art project called Fashion Victims. It's a commentary on the real victims of the fashion industry, more than 1,100 people who died in the Rana Plaza factory collapse in Bangladesh. Dominguez describes the crowd's reaction to her work.
Most people was taking photos. Few people stopped, one of them very worried with tears in her eyes, and others looked up thinking that they had fallen from a floor. But many people also directly related Bangladesh, even the police. They asked if it was a protest for Bangladesh, and they thought it was very good, the policemen.
Clothing and purchase orders from the Spanish retailers Mango and El Corte Inglés were found in the rubble of the Rana Plaza factory. Within weeks, Spanish companies signed unprecedented fire and building safety agreements for their factories there. I want to see proof that companies are following the rules and doing right by their workers in third world countries, says one shopper, Patricia Barrera, outside H&M. I'd even be willing to pay more, though I think the companies could afford it themselves. Complying with such safety demands means some serious due diligence on the part of retailers, who often don't know which sub-subcontractors they're employing. Philip Moscoso is a fashion industry expert at Spain's IESE Business School.
You may be working with a company which then, and this happens in Bangladesh, but happens also in China and other countries, itself subcontracts to even other people.
Nevertheless, Moscoso calls the Rana Plaza disaster a wake-up call that could lead to the creation of fair trade labels for certain fashion lines.
They start to have both kind of customers at the end of the day, those which are willing to pay a bit more and having the brand of fair trade, and those which somehow just rather like to think that they can trust when companies say that they fulfill that.
It could take years for fast fashion to become fair trade fashion. Consumers are outraged right now about the deaths at Rana Plaza. But with $5 fashions and Spain's economic crisis, will they still be in 3 years? The artist Yolanda Dominguez wants people to stay angry and keep up the pressure on retailers. She's produced a video of her Fashion Victims project, mixing scenes of high fashion with sirens from the tragedy in Bangladesh. And she hopes to recreate her art installation in shopping venues around the world. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
For the next 3 days, we're going to look at the growing problem of suicides in the U.S. military. Despite the drawdown of troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, the number of suicides continues to rise. The questions are why and what to do about it. We'll take you to an Army base in Texas, where a new suicide prevention program seems to be working, and we'll have that report tomorrow. Today, we have the story of Marine Nicholas Rodriguez. His family's history of service goes back to the Revolutionary War, so it was no surprise when he enlisted. His mother and stepfather told his story to producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister.
My name is Anna Rodriguez, and I live in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. I am the proud mother of Lance Corporal Nicholas Rodriguez.
My name's Michael Geiger. I'm the proud stepfather of Nicholas Rodriguez.
Nick was 21 years old when he enlisted.
He wanted to go and help the world in some way he saw fit.
His home base was going to be in San Diego, California, Camp Pendleton. So this was kind of the first time in his life that he was 3,000 miles away. Cried my heart out. And I've been crying ever since.
Nick would call me probably every other day or so, just to bat the breeze. And he'd say, well, what kind of music did you listen to when you were a kid? And I would give him these names. One group he became very fond of was Uriah Heep. There was one song in particular. It was Nick's favorite, Lady in Black.
And I begged her, give me horses to trample down my enemy. So eager was my passion to devour this waste of life.
He was with the 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance. And, oh, he was so gung-ho about this. He said it was like he was inside a video game. And this was the greatest thing since sliced bread to Nick.
When he left for Afghanistan, we didn't get to talk that often. When we did, I always got, Mom, it's boring out here. We're not doing anything. And that made me feel awesome. I still came down my driveway and stopped breathing, praying to God I wouldn't have two Marines sitting there. But at the same time, I thought, well, why would that happen? He's not in combat. I think it was in mid-November, he called from Afghanistan and said, I'm on my way home.
He had to go through some kind of process like a debriefing. He said that they had him sit down and watch some videos and stuff and asked him a whole bunch of questions, things like, well, you're going to assure us that when you get home, you're not going to beat your wife, you're not going to call your mother names, you're not going to be nasty to your pets and things like that. Nick seemed confident that he didn't have any issues that he was worried about, so he flew home.
I called everybody I knew. Nick's coming home. Nick's coming home.
Just knowing that Nick was returning from combat, I said, please don't ask him how many guys he killed. Please don't ask him how many bombs he saw go off.
Seems to be a military person that comes back home from war. You don't ask them stuff like that. That's kind of like, maybe the unwritten rule. So we didn't. We knew that if Nick wanted to tell, we would be there to listen. But there were cracks, and I started to see them.
I knew there was something different about Nick. One of the first things he wanted to do when he returned home here was he went out and bought him a pistol.
A .357. That's what Nick wanted. His drinking skyrocketed, went through the ceiling. We were at a New Year's Eve party, and there was food and there was beer.
He was manning the fire pit. And around midnight, one of the neighbors threw an M80. Nick hit the dirt, belly first, flat down.
When I saw Nick hit the ground after a firework went off, I knew there was more that went on over there than he was telling me. And then he wasn't sleeping at all. He was on guard. Nick just happened to be outside in the middle of the night, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and his truck drives by and throws something at the house. He ran after my newspaper lady.
He jumped over our fence. He ended up face first across the hood of her car. But she was scared to death. And then he looked and she says, I'm just delivering the paper. And he said everything was okay. And he walked back home. And I called the paper carrier that afternoon and explained. She says, oh, that's quite all right. Tell him thank you for his service. I thought, well, young boy just came home from a combat zone. He's going to be a little jumpy. And that's where I left it lay.
I was confused because my son was hurting. And I didn't know what to do. I couldn't even identify it.
After Nick left Pennsylvania and went back to Camp Pendleton, he said that things were bothering him. He said that he was getting some headaches. He had talked about an incident where they were patrolling somewhere and he saw a little Afghani boy come out from behind a wall and drew a gun on him. All he could remember is his nieces and nephews at home here. And now he's sitting there face to face with an 8 or 9 year old boy with a gun in his hand. What do you do? Just that quick, he would drop the conversation.
I said, Michael, that's it. I'm going to show up at Camp Pendleton. I'm going to call him up and say, meet me at the gate. I'm here. We need to talk.
We had told him that maybe he should see a doctor to make sure that there was nothing wrong. He assured us that he would, but nobody there had any record of him ever being seen by a doctor.
things just didn't feel right, but I chose not to go. I just did nothing.
And then he called me up. I'll never forget it. It was about 20 minutes till 7 our time, and I was up getting ready to go to work. He told me that he was so impatient he had to get in touch with me ASAP. He said that that band that I had turned him on to, Uriah Heep, they're going to be in San Francisco. He says, I'm going to fly you out, and you and me are going to go see this concert. I says, fantastic. We talked a little bit about this and that. He said they were going to redeploy to Afghanistan sometime in December of that year. And he said he was all pumped up. So took me by surprise. I got home from work early that day, and there's two Marines in uniform standing there. And I'm thinking to myself, did the kid go AWOL? And they had this real stern and serious look on their face. It says, is Anna Rodriguez here? Could you go get her because we don't want to create a scene?
March 1st, I was working the day shift at the shoe store. And I saw Michael walking through the front doors. He had this look on his face. He didn't say a word. There were customers in my store. I said, no, not Nick. Not Nick. And he said, there's two Marines at the door. You need to come home.
Brought her home here, and they let us know that Nick was gone.
They found him in the bathroom on base. Well, the gunshot to his chest. That's all they said.
And they told us that it happened at 4:20 a.m. California time. And I told them they were liars right then and there. I told them, I says, that's impossible. I says, you're telling me he got off the phone with me and he took his own life?
It was his .357 that he bought when he was home. That was the weapon.
Lance Corporal Nicholas T. Rodriguez, 23, of Whitehall, died peacefully on Tuesday, March 1st at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton, San Diego, California. Nicholas was born December 11th, 1987 in Allentown.
Most of this was written by me. The died peacefully, I didn't do that. I think the funeral home didn't know what else to say. That has always bugged me. Everybody who knows how Nick died knows it wasn't peacefully.
Nick never indicated to anybody that he had ever thought about it or considered taking his own life. It wasn't until later, and it was much later, where they put two and two together and said that it had to have been PTSD.
I never heard of PTSD. I had no idea what it was.
Nobody ever said that we needed to be on the lookout for different behaviors. We thought, you know, 9 months in a combat zone, he's going to be a little bit changed, but we never had any reason to think it would be long-term. He came home to us physically intact.
I started counseling through the VA immediately after Nick had died. I ended up getting the perfect counselor, too. She's the one who explained PTSD to me, and that's where I was educated after he died. I found out through a couple military personnel that a little boy that came around the corner with a gun, well, it was a 12-year-old boy with an AK-47, and he was shooting at Nick and Nick's unit. And Nick is the one who put that child down. I also know that Nick was dealing with losing his best friend over there. I remember hearing somebody say that Nick was kneeled down next to him when he died.
In hindsight now, I look back and think, well, these were all red flags that were going up, and we never saw them. We didn't know they were red flags. I think somebody from the military should step up and come to the family's homes before that child is returned and let them know that if you see anything like this, here's a number, contact somebody, because we don't know what we're dealing with.
Hi, Nick. How are you, honey? We're at the Cedar Hill Memorial Cemetery where my Nick is buried. Anywhere between once and twice a week, I come down here to see Nick.
It's a silent killer is what it is in my eyes, because in the paper you read about this guy was killed by an IED. This guy was killed by gunfire. And it's not to take anything away from those boys or girls, because they're all heroes. But what about all the boys and girls that are coming home, but they're not together, they're not whole, that they lost it mentally? You don't see anybody talking about them. We go and see all these memorials and monuments to these brave young boys and girls that are sacrificing their all out there in the fields. My son's name ain't on those memorials. Why? He died as a result of that war. If he wouldn't have gone to Afghanistan, he wouldn't be under the ground now.
I still deal with a lot of guilt. Hell yeah. I might have been able to change the outcome. I'm his mother. It's the first time in my entire life that my kid needed help, and I wasn't there. I feel like I failed my son.
Here's a song called Lady in Black.
We played this for Nick at his funeral. These here are the lyrics, and when I listened to them more closely after Nick had passed away, it gave me a little more understanding. This was what Nick felt. She asked me, name my foe then. I said, the need within some men to fight and kill their brothers without thought of love or God. And I begged her, give me horses to trample down my enemy. So eager was my passion to devour this waste of life. But she wouldn't think of battle that reduces men to animals, so easy to begin and yet impossible to end. And then it just goes on.
Nick's case was investigated by the Marine Corps, and the report concluded this. He received an adequate amount of suicide awareness training, not only from his chain of command, but through the battalion chaplain's warrior transitioning training received both in Afghanistan and upon his return to the United States. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at one promising program in Texas. Coming Home, Nick's Story was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions with support from the National Endowment for the Arts, KCRW's Independent Producer Project, and Iraq War veteran songwriter Jason Moon and his Warrior Songs Project. There's more about Nick's story at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.